Sometimes the fun begins when the paved road ends. Chevy Silverado 2500 HD is made to work hard and play hard on the road or off. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com for details and experience life in HD.
Okay, there's been a lot made about the price of Teslas and all the protests and what's happening. Are they still selling things? For what it's worth, Tesla went up 12% today in its stock. In the last 6 months, Tesla is up 9%. In a year, the Tesla is up 61% in their stocks. Over 5 years, Tesla stock is up 711%. So perhaps the doom and gloom isn't all it's made up to be. I don't know. Tom Appel, you seem to know a lot about these sorts of things. Welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me, John.
I mean, has Tesla's demise been maybe overstated a little bit?
I'm wondering if it's a little understated.
Really?
Yeah. What's going on here? I don't think Tesla's going away anytime soon, but I think that the old shine is kind of buffing off of the stock. And one of the issues is that the sales are definitely down, and we're only tracking stuff here in the U.S. about stuff here in the U.S. Tesla's got big problems in China and Western Europe too that are going to end up mattering a lot during the next earnings call.
How far down are sales, and what period are we looking at that we know we have the data for?
So in America, we don't get sales right away because Tesla does not report sales, so we have to wait for registration numbers, for example. But we have numbers for January. They're down about 11%, which doesn't sound big, but if you remove Tesla from the numbers, overall EV sales are up 44%. So in a market that is way up, Tesla is down in the U.S., and then I think the last numbers for Western Europe, we saw that in Germany, Tesla sales are down 70%, and they're down about 50% in China.
Whoa, and those numbers are January down 11, and that was probably before we saw kind of the big push over the last couple of weeks and maybe month of the protest and the other things that are going on.
Yeah, really strange period, and I think that it'd be very difficult to make any sort of long-term projections based on what's going on right now, because people are rushing out to buy electric vehicles because they're worried that the tax incentives are going to disappear, and they may well disappear. So it's interesting that in that environment where people are rushing out to buy electric vehicles, they're not buying Tesla. Additionally, Cars.com recently reported that searches for used Tesla are down dramatically. And we're seeing that the Tesla used car prices are dropping big time.
I've been hearing anecdotal evidence of people that own Teslas rushing to try and sell them and not able to do so. I've heard of some people, this is what I've been seeing on X, that, oh my goodness, I can't even get insurance for my Tesla because of all the vandalism out there. Is this more anecdotal, or do you actually see stories that bear some legitimacy to these stories that we're hearing?
The difficult to sell thing is absolutely true, and there's lots of solid evidence to support that. I'm seeing lots of individual stories about people rushing out to sell their cars. I don't know how true that is, but I do know that used car prices do not make it very inviting to sell your Tesla.
Well, when a car company gets in trouble like this, what is it, a new model or something exciting that's supposed to bring customers back? Is there anything in the pipeline that we know of that Tesla has to try and reverse their fortune?
We don't know of anything specific. There was supposed to be a sports car. We haven't heard about that very much. And then there was supposed to be the $25,000 car, sometimes called the Model 2 or the Model Q. But that seems unlikely. One of the problems Tesla has now, because sales have shrunk and their capacity is extended, they can't build a plant in Mexico where they could have possibly built something that affordable.
I know that Tesla built a factory to make their cars in China. Why are they struggling there?
That's their biggest factory, and that factory is capable of producing something like 1 million cars a year. It may be the largest car factory on the planet. The problem in China is that Tesla butts head with the government there a lot, and additionally, there is a wave of nationalism in China unrelated to Tesla directly, where Chinese people now want to buy Chinese-made vehicles. Good for the local industry, not good for other industry. And we see that BMW and Mercedes and General Motors and Volkswagen are running into the exact same problem there.
You mentioned that sales of electric vehicles in January up 44%, Tesla down 11%. 224 texted in, so what, are you going to buy electric cars from China, from another overseas company? That's just ridiculous. Well, is it local? I mean, there's other electric vehicle makers here in the U.S. too, right?
Oh, lots of them, lots of them. BMW, Hyundai, Kia, General Motors. There's lots of electric vehicles to buy here.
I don't want to like paint it all as doom and gloom, Tom, because I just want to like make sure I'm getting this at all angles. Do you see any light at the end of the tunnel for Tesla in some way, shape, or form through this?
I think this is going. They're going to be weathering, I think, a storm for a while. I think the next earnings report is going to be very gloomy. People are going to back away from the company for a while. They do have the robo-taxi in the works. I don't see any serious sales volume coming from that, but it might be really good PR if that actually worked and sold reasonably well.
Okay, that's our Tesla report here for today with Tom Appel. What's Cadillac doing? They're killing off their sedans?
Yeah, Cadillac, that's another company to turn for electric vehicles. Cadillac's doing very well with electric vehicles, but they still sell two sedans. People might remember sedans. They've been replaced mostly by crossovers, but the Cadillac CT4 and CT5 will not see a new generation. So Cadillac will be getting rid of its last cars. They'll be all crossover after this.
Are sedans popular at all anymore with any company?
Not in the U.S. They're pretty popular in Western Europe, and they like them in China, too.
Okay. What's going on with Ford, a big recall for one of their most popular vehicles?
Oh, what a headache. It's not quite a recall yet, but it almost certainly will become one. 2015 through 2017 Ford F-150s, that's the truck we see everywhere, most popular vehicle in the U.S., the F-150 is probably going to be recalled for a problem, and it's an awful problem, where the transmission will suddenly drop from whatever gear it's in into first gear, which is roughly the equivalent of slamming very hard on the brakes. It's a big problem. They've gotten 138 complaints from customers, and they're probably just going to have this fixed. So huge recall, going to be expensive.
Is it a software recall, or is it something the cars are going to have to come in to do?
I don't know. I get the sense that it's a mechanical issue, so they may have to replace transmissions. If it's a software issue, it's a lot more affordable.
Okay. I did want to ping one last thing. You mentioned that electric vehicle sales were up even though Tesla was down. Is this countering the narrative of last year that anyone that wanted an electric vehicle had already gotten one? Are we seeing this rebound, like you said, to try and get ahead of these credits?
Yeah, I think people have been dragging their feet. I think they've been thinking about buying an electric vehicle, and this is chasing them to do that. So these are really pull-ahead sales. These are probably sales we would have seen this year, perhaps. People want to buy these vehicles. I don't know if there's any new serious enthusiasm for EVs. I wish there was. But I think this is just a response to the possibility that the $7,500 tax credit is going away.
Okay. Where can people listen to more that you do with Consumer Guide Automotive?
Oh, check us out at consumerguide.com, and a new issue of the Car Stuff podcast just dropped.
All right. And you're on with Steve and Johnny on Saturday, right?
I am. Thank you for mentioning it. Yes, I am.
At what time? Do you know?
I'll be joining them at midnight.
Midnight, so Saturday into Sunday morning, the midnight hour, the witching hour with Tom Appel. I like that. Count in whatever day of the week that is. Okay, day of the month that is. All right, we'll be listening Saturday night into Sunday morning. Tom, take care, okay?
Take care, thanks.
It's Tom Appel, Consumer Guide Automotive. Let's take a break. We'll chat a little more before the news on Your Money Matters on WGN. Bad credit or credit card debt that carries over can be detrimental. There's some do's and don'ts when you have that situation. Ted Rossman is going to join us now to chat through some of those things. Ted, it's good to talk to you, my friend. How are you?
Good to be here. Doing well. Thank you.
I know that people love to chase good credit card rewards. I guess you can do that at your own peril, right? Like, you want to get good rewards on credit cards, but some people are primed up for that better than others.
I love credit card rewards, too, but it's important to point out that these are only worth it if you pay in full and avoid interest. I know that may sound obvious, but our recent survey found 72% of people with credit card debt are pursuing credit card rewards. That's a big mistake because the average credit card charges about 20%. And a typical rewards payout is often something like 1 or 2%. Now, maybe you could do a little better in certain categories like 3, 4, 5, perhaps even 6% cash back or a similar amount of airline miles. But none of that holds a candle to the interest charges that people are paying. So if you have credit card debt, no shame. A lot of people do. It's often for practical reasons. But you have to knock out the debt before chasing rewards.
What's the problem with it, right, about getting a card maybe that does 3% cash back on groceries? If that's your major purchase, isn't that helping you with your credit card debt ultimately? Or is the chase of the card hurting your credit score or just making you focus in the wrong areas? What is actually wrong with it?
The math only works out in your favor if you're paying in full and avoiding interest, because credit card interest rates are so high. At an average of 20%, over the course of the year, you're paying $20 in interest for every $100 you're borrowing. And in the form of rewards, maybe you're only getting $2 back or something like that. That's where a lot of people are upside down. And, you know, maybe they go in with the best of intentions that they're going to pay it off, and then they end up carrying a balance, or maybe they're just not thinking of it in those terms. But yeah, credit card rates are so high that, you know, it reminds me of my favorite industry saying, is that credit cards are like power tools. They could be really useful or dangerous. It's all about how you use them. And it really comes down to whether you're paying interest or not. Roughly half of cardholders pay in full every month. And for them, life is great. They take full advantage of rewards and other benefits. But for the other half, more or less, who are paying interest, that's where it can rack up in a hurry.
I imagine if you're trying to chase after a reward, you apply for a new credit card, you have a low credit score, let's say, because you're carrying a balance or you've had some issues in the past, you're paying an even higher interest rate than maybe you were on your existing card. Like, chasing one after the other can be troublesome.
It can, yeah. We found that 6 in 10 people with credit card debt have had it for at least a year. It's important to try to break this cycle. A balance transfer card is a great way to do that. Many of these don't offer rewards, but that's okay. The benefit here is the 0% interest rate. There are cards that will let you avoid interest for up to 24 months, actually. That's a new development as of this month.
Whoa.
There's a new long-term leader, the U.S. Bank Shield Visa, 24 months with no interest. Previously, the longest on the market was 21. That's an amazing option for people that have credit card debt, because you move it over to this new card. I say don't add any new purchases, just divide what you owe by the number of months in that 0% term. Really try to stick to that level payment plan. That's what's going to give you the best odds of success.
It's not free, though, right? They usually charge something for that transfer.
They do charge you a 3 to 5% fee upfront on most of these cards. I still think that's well worth it, provided you can make progress. The average credit card balance is around $6,000. So you think to transfer that over, maybe that's between $180 and $300, but you could save thousands of dollars in interest charges potentially. Like, if you make minimum payments at 20% towards a $6,000 balance, you're in debt for about 18 years, and you end up paying about $9,000 in interest. So that's where minimum payments are not nearly enough. The quicker you can knock out this debt at the lowest possible interest rate, that's a huge advantage.
Okay, I'm just crunching the numbers. $6,000 in debt. Let's say it costs 3% to balance transfer. That's $180. Okay. And let's say I get 24 months. I'm going to do some more math on my calculator. It's $250 a month. You're probably getting close to that with your minimum payment anyways. And like you said, that'll take 18 years. You do it $250 a month. You don't put any more purchases on. You do that for 24 months. You're done in 2 years. Wow, that's huge.
That's what's really incredible. Yeah, a couple reasons for that. One is that the minimum payment math is so brutal because the typical formula is just 1% of the balance plus interest. So you're really not making much headway. But yeah, when you break it up that way, it sounds a lot more affordable, doesn't it? That $6,000 sounds like a lot, but then you say, well, could you come up with $250 a month? And then you get a lot more heads nodding. So that's a great option. You typically need good to excellent credit. It doesn't have to be top-notch. I mean, usually a score of about 700 or better will get you one of these cards. And some other good ones are City Simplicity and Wells Fargo Reflect. They have 21 months interest-free. If you have a lower credit score, or if you have a lot of debt, maybe more than $5,000 or $6,000, because sometimes it's hard to transfer all the amount that you want to transfer, like if you owe $10,000, instead, I would suggest nonprofit credit counseling. Someone like Money Management International or GreenPath, they can often negotiate a 6 or 7% rate over 4 or 5 years. But back to our main point here, don't go after rewards if you have debt. You really want to prioritize this payoff. That's going to be better for your overall financial situation.
Can you say those two nonprofit organizations you listed off there again?
Sure, yeah. Money Management International and GreenPath are two very good large national credit counseling organizations. And
that's great.
The card issuers play ball with them because it's been proven to work. And, you know, frankly, a card issuer's biggest fear is people don't pay them back. So, you know, you might say, well, why would they be willing to do this? Why would they settle for 6 or 7% when they could get 20? They want to get paid back, so they are willing to cut people a break. These nonprofit credit counselors do this all the time. So they set up these debt management plans. They hold clients' hands through the payback process. It's really an amazing option. I like to say it's hiding in plain sight a little bit because it almost sounds too good to be true, but there are some really good groups. The National Foundation for Credit Counseling has some other good options.
I'll have to dive into that more another time. Ted, we appreciate your time, and thanks for everything that you do at Bankrate.
No problem. Thank you.
James Rodriguez is here. He's a senior real estate reporter at Business Insider. James, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So did anything change? Is anyone actually able to get a better deal on their commissions, or are we all just still stuck with that 6% we had for so long?
Well, as you pointed out, the results have been a little underwhelming. So you are seeing a lot of people still doing more or less the same old thing in which the buyer pays the seller cuts their agent a check of between 5% or 6% of the sale price, and then that agent then splits it with the buyer's agent. So it's this whole convoluted system, and these new rules kind of tried to upend it. There have been a lot of workarounds. It's kind of, there's ways for people to do things the old way. But what I found in talking to people is there are actually savvy buyers out there and sellers who are flexing their negotiating power, who are negotiating down commissions. And I talked to discount brokerages as well that see an opportunity to lure more clients by basically offering less than the standard commission. And so we're starting to see some changes at the margins here, and that's what I find really interesting going on today.
James, someone's explained this to me 1,000 times, and I've bought and sold the property, and I still don't get it. Who negotiates, like, who is this supposed to benefit? The buyer who can say, hey, I want a buying agent that's only going to get 1%, or is it the seller who negotiates with the selling agent what they're ultimately going to give the buying agent? I'm just confused, like, who has the power to negotiate this?
Yeah, it's a really interesting point, and I think a big reason that commissions have kind of stayed the way that they are is because both sides can kind of shift the onus to the other side. It used to be that buyer's agents used to be able to tell their clients that their services were free, so there wasn't a lot of incentive for buyers to negotiating it because it was kind of all happening out of their view. And for sellers, you know, they could argue that it's basically, you know, the buyer's the one fronting the down payment and the mortgage. I think both sides do have an opportunity to negotiate here. So on the seller side, one of the advice that I hear from people who are advocating for bringing commissions down is if you're a seller, you kind of have the power when you're listing a home to state what you're offering the buyer's agent. And you could just say, make me an offer and I'll give you some money back after the sale closes to pay your agent what you have agreed to, you as a buyer with your agent. So if you've agreed to 1% or 2% or the going, you know, say it's 3% in your area, we can discuss that. And on the buyer's side, it's about shopping for an agent before you, move forward on the home search and really getting it clear with your agent what the expectations are for their role and what you expect to be paying them. And in some cases, I've seen buyers use their arrangement with their agent as a bargaining chip almost. So they say, look, you as a seller, you may be offering 3% to a buyer's agent after the deal closes, but I've only agreed to pay my agent 1.5%. So that's an extra 1.5% that you get to keep in your pocket. You only have to give me 1.5% back after the deal closes. And that can be a way to kind of sweeten the deal. So
it's interesting. So you almost have to take the agents out of the equation and make that deal directly with the seller. Agents want nothing more than to be part of every conversation between buyer and seller. That's not easy to do. I think that explanation you gave makes sense, but it kind of alludes to why this is so hard to crack.
Yeah, and you make a crucial point there, which is a lot of times if you're working with an agent, they're going to be the one that are in these negotiations with you. They're going to be writing the offers on your behalf. And so it is about making an agreement with your agent and just being really upfront about the expectations here. So while there are a lot of agents that are very eager to, or, you know, very keen on preserving the existing commission structure, there are a lot of agents out there, period. And the National Association of Realtors has some 1.5 million members around the country. So what people are expecting eventually, and again, this hasn't happened yet, but that eventually you will start to see agents competing more on price. And again, there may be some agents out there that can say, look, I've achieved these results with my previous clients. I'm worth every penny of my commission. I'm not going to move off of 2.5% or 3%. And that's fine. They're well within their rights to do that. There may just end up being other agents out there that are willing to go lower if it means winning more business.
Yeah, and James, I think you're hitting on something here, is that maybe these discount places that are already kind of trying to offer less to help list it or to help buy it or whatever it is, they're mm-hmm. the most primed to do this because they're already kind of taking the face out of the equation. They're making it a faceless agent job anyways, basically.
Yeah, and some of them that I did talk to, they do employ agents who they basically use AI software to speed up some of the more mundane parts of the job, like comparing comparable sales in the area or going through a disclosure report. They can speed up those things and allow them, say this agent is just charging a flat fee of $10,000 instead of the 2 or 3%, allows them to take on more deals at a time and still provide some of that personal handholding when you do want, because I think a lot of buyers and sellers and surveys show this, do still want a human, in their court.
Right, at the end of the day.
Yeah.
But I think that they're able, I think they're just more primed up to be able to do this. I'm sorry to cut you off there, James. I am out of time.
Not at all.
Every time you come on, it's a thought-provoking one. We'll have to dive into it again another time, James. Thanks for joining us, okay?
Sounds great. Thank you.